I would like to read two verses just as I start. First one is found in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 15. And that from a child thou hast known the holy scriptures, which are able to make thee wise unto salvation through the faith which is in Christ Jesus. The second one is found in Revelation 14, verse 3. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth, yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labours and their works to follow them. As I give my testimony tonight, I would like to tell how the Lord saved me and brought me that I'm standing here. I'd also like to speak or say a few things about some of the people that were faithful in the years gone past. They're no longer with us, because both sides of our families, they had little time or no time for anybody that called themselves a Christian. They would have went to the Church of Ireland on a Sunday in the pub Saturday night before they got there, and that was as far as their religion went. In some attempts that my mother and father made to get them to go to missions, they were very hostile in their reaction to what was being tried. First of all, I would say I was born into a Christian home, and my parents were very zealous for the faith. I was number 4 out of 8, 5 girls and 3 boys, and it was our parents' great desire that we would, each of us, would come to faith early in life, in faith in Jesus Christ. And so we were taught the things of God from a very early age, family devotions every night, and every night we each one had to pray, and my mother would read from the scriptures. At evening prayers one night, my older brother, he got very concerned about something he had done that day, and he became a wee bit emotional about it, and he started talking to my mother about it. And finally, of course, her answer probably in a roundabout way was that you need to get right with God, you need to ask Jesus into your heart, and that's what he done that night. And I was sitting there watching him till this, and then I decided I would do the same. I didn't really understand what it was all about, but it was something that my mother was in a great way that each one of her children should do. So that night I said the sinner's prayer, and that night, while I was very, very young, I have no doubt that there was a great change, because from that night on, I sought to walk in the way that I should walk, and of things that I might think I should do later on in life, well, you would consider, is that really what you should do whenever you were a Christian? I grew up on a farm where my father worked. He didn't own the farm, but he worked on it, but we near enough owned the place. We weren't very rich, but beyond that, we had great wealth. We had no car. We lived in a house that looked like Dunluce Castle, only we had slates on it, and there was no modern conveniences in the house. I remember my mother taking me by the hand, going to the well for a bucket of water and coming back again. I remember her panicking because it was getting dark and she couldn't find the stuff to light the tilly lamp. And I remember the water coming, and they put a standpipe in the corner of the, what we call the scullery, they now call it the kitchen, and set a bucket under it, and they thought it was a great job because they didn't have to go to the well anymore. And then they got the water in, eventually they got a sink in, and little by little the house improved. And then whenever I took over, we really renovated the house proper. One person that, there's several persons that I would think of tonight that had a great influence on our family. And one of them was, her maiden name was Emma Gordon. She later became Emma Anderson. She was reared in Tynan. And she belonged to, she was Presbyterian by birth and Methodist by conviction. She attended the Methodist Sunday School. She was born way back, about in the 1880s. She was 6 years old at the time of the railway disaster, and she was on that train that day going to Warren Point. she became ill whenever she was about 40, late 30s, 40s. She had breast cancer, and she had four of a family. She had three girls and two boys, and one of those boys had a great influence on our family. The children were at school one day, and she became very ill. She had been very ill the night before. She'd been out trying to bed calves and do some of the redding up around the yard, but she became very ill the next day, and they got the doctor, and the doctor said the time was short. So the serving man was sent down to the school to bring home the children, and they were all brought home. And they were brought up into the room, and there their mother said goodbye to them. And later on, she passed away. She had two sons. One son was Jimmy. Jimmy later grew up, and he bought a farm in Hillsborough. He became a very fervent Free Presbyterian in Hillsborough. A church was built on his land. He also became an elder in Hillsborough, and later on he was an elder in Lisburn. The older boy was John, and later on my mother went to work there, and it was John that invited her to a mission, gave her a Bible. She didn't have a Bible. My mother was born in Madden in March 1925. There was no Christian witness at all in her family. Of course, as I said, they went to church, but they were very hostile as to anybody that would talk about being saved or anything like that. She was born just beside Madden Schoolhouse, and that's where she started to attend school, but then they moved house, and they were 3 miles away from the school, so she had to walk 3 miles each day to school. When she was 11, the doctor came to school one day, and he done what doctors do, and he picked my mother out, and he said she was very, very ill, and he sent her home, and he sent somebody along with her and said she wasn't to run because she had a bad heart. I think later on they discovered maybe she had a leaking valve in her heart, and that was it. So she was sent home from school, and she never was back at school. But her teacher, Mrs. Hughes, who lived just across the road, she sent home lessons, and she did do fairly well. She did learn to read and write and count and so forth, but her ambition was to be a teacher, which she never was. My father was born in Caledon in 1919, and he certainly had no time for religion and little time for school. He worked on local farms whenever, well, probably before he should have been working on them, and this was in the 20s and the 30s, and whenever he was 17, he decided he would join the army. So him and another fella, Joe Brown from Middletown, his people owned a pub in Middletown, and a fella at the bottom of the lane where he worked, he was working in a farm and living on a farm just outside Middletown. They decided they would go and join the army, so he got up early one morning and headed down the lane, and the boy at the foot of the lane, whenever he got there, he decided he couldn't be bothered getting out of bed, so he went on ahead, and Joe Brown went with him, and to the best of my knowledge, they walked to Loma, and they joined the army. The Irish Fusiliers. Whenever he was signing on, he was actually underage, and he told them what they needed to hear, and asked him his religion. He said he had no religion at all. So then they said, well, you must be a Protestant. So they put him down as Church of Ireland. And then they weren't satisfied with that. They asked him, was he ever confirmed? So he said he wasn't confirmed. He never had been. So then he had to go to confirmation classes. He said he wasn't much interested in confirmation classes, but after a wee while, the war broke out, so then it was all forgot about. So he walked to Oma and joined the army, and then he was sent to England for training. After training, he was sent to Malta, and he became part of the garrison in Malta. He was in Malta whenever the war broke out. His colonel was a Colonel Edgerton from Loughgall, who actually was a Roman Catholic but was very, very loyal to the British and the British flag. He was in Malta then when war broke out. So when war broke out, Malta became under siege, and there was a great siege in Malta. It was the most bombed piece of earth in the world at that time. The Italians bombed by day and the Germans bombed by night. And he told many a story of some of the atrocities, some of the horrific injuries and the deaths that he's seen during that time. In 1942, Churchill decided there would be a convoy sent to relieve Malta. So this convoy left England. There was 14 merchant ships and I don't know how many destroyers and battle ships and stuff went with the convoy, but it was a fairly large convoy, and it was just decimated on its way to Malta. Eventually it did get in. In that convoy was the British borrowed an oil tanker from the Americans. She was called the Ohio. And they were sailing along, and whenever the bombing was going, the Ohio was hit, and her steering was badly damaged, and she wouldn't sail straight. All she would do was go around in circles and go all over the place. So they got two destroyers. The rest of the convoy sailed on, because convoy couldn't stop, because if you stopped or slowed down, you were sitting duck for the U-boats. So the convoy sailed on, but two destroyers stayed behind. And they got up each side of the oil tanker and they lashed it to the destroyers, and they carried it in to the harbour in Malta. At that time, my father was in Malta up the mountain, he said, with jackhammers. Those are the big hammers that the roadmen used to use for digging up the roads. And he was digging mass graves for the people that would be killed when the convoy come in, and for the dead that would come in on the convoy. Whenever the convoy did come in, they asked for volunteers to go down onto the ships to tidy up the ships. He said he didn't volunteer, but his friend volunteered and went onto the ship. And he said it was really a terrible scene. They were brought to a pile of body bags, and they were told to go about the ship and gather up the makings of a body. Two arms, two legs, whatever. Didn't matter if they're two left arms or whatever. As long as you gather up the makings of a body, you put them in the bag, lace the bag up, put a label on unknown, set it in the pile, and went and done the same again. He left Malta then, and he was sent to Palestine. He was in the Sahara Desert with Montgomery, and he was in round, I don't really know exactly where, but he did talk about swimming in the Suez Canal. He spent some time in the Sahara Desert fighting, and he talked about some of the horrific fighting that was going on there. I asked him one time, did he ever shoot anybody? He says he didn't know. He said he fired at them, they fell, but he said there was other people shooting too. But whenever he was dying, one of the things he said, that he was glad that he never shot anybody, but possibly he meant he never knowingly shot anybody. He was in the Sahara Desert in Palestine for a while, and then what happened was Hitler, the Nazis were planning to invade England, and they had massed along the border of France and Normandy, but because of bad weather, they were unable to come across. They were coming across in flat-bottom barges, and the sea had to be fairly calm, or the barges would sink. So their invasion had to be put off. But then the Allies, they knew or started that they would have to go back across till Europe. So the invasion in Europe was planned. So the Americans at this time had entered the war, and the American military was coming over here. They were stationed in Tainan at that time, the train there. They were stationed, well, all over the place. In fact, some people said they brought that much armour and stuff with them that they wondered why Ireland didn't sink. So the Germans knew that there was a great invasion coming. across the border, across to the coast of France. They had Saint Rommel, who was one of Hitler's greatest generals. He was the general that had kept beating the British in North Africa in the Sahara to the Saint Montgomery, and then he finished them off at Alamein. They had sent him to the north of France, and he had really reinforced the entire coast along that area. If you go over there, you'll see the reinforcements even yet. I have visited all the beaches in that area that the Allies invaded, and seen some of the concrete bunkers and the great defences that the Germans had built over there. So the Americans, or the the Allies was getting ready to invade France, but they knew that they would have to draw the might of the German army away from the north coast of France, so they would have to open up a second front. They did open up a second front in Italy. They invaded the island of Sicily and went across into the mainland and battled their way up through Italy to draw the Germans back from Normandy. But Churchill, he decided there would have to be a decoy whenever the invasion would start in Sicily. And if you ever seen the film that was on television not so long ago, it was about the man, I think it was called The Man That Never Was. The Germans got a drunk from Glasgow, the body of a drunk from Glasgow, and they dressed him up as a British major. They got a briefcase with bogus invasion plans, and they chained it to his wrist. They made him look as if he was a genuine officer. He even had a love letter in his pocket from his fiancée. And they took him on a submarine and they threw him out where the tide would bring him in till a port that was occupied by Germany. In the meantime, the British gathered up what they called war-weary troops, and they took them to an island off Greece, and they dumped them in an island in Greece as a decoy to make the Germans believe that this was where the invasion started. My father, he was part of that decoy, and he was dumped in Greece. And it took me a long time figuring out why he was told he needn't be fighting, because there'd be no supplies coming through to them. The only thing, there'd be a lot of them get killed if they don't have any fighting. So they surrendered right away. He said, to his knowledge, there was only three people got off the island. He said there was three officers got into the boat and rowed over the horizon. They said they would rather die than be taken prisoner with the Germans. So he didn't know. He doesn't know if they made it any place or not. He was taken prisoner off the island. He was put in a train. Train was kettle wagons that were packed in so tight. He said there was a bucket in the corner to do what you wanted to do, but he said for anybody to get to the bucket, everybody had to get up and move around, and they were really packed in like sardines. He said they went off, and after a few days, he said there was a guard sitting up in the top corner. He could see into two of these open top kettle wagons. He said if he didn't like you, well, he shot you. And after a few days, he says, as the soldiers died, he says they were throughout along the track, and after a few days there was plenty of room in the carriage, but he made it anyway. He made it till Germany. He was taken to the Black Forest in Germany, and there he was put in a prison camp. He was in that prison camp for 18 months. They were sent to work in a quarry. He said the face of the quarry was very high. It was a good three stories high. He said every morning they were brought out at first light, and railway wagons rolled down. There was railway tracks down the front of the quarry face, and railway wagons rolled down. He said every man had a sledgehammer, and every man had to move 10 ton of stones into the railway wagon from the quarry face. Every day at 12 o'clock, they were fed. And if you want to lose weight, there's a good diet for you. He said they got a pint of porridge, which was more water than porridge, and they got two potatoes, which were more rotten than good. And that was their food till the next day at 12 o'clock. And on that day, they had to hook 10 ton of stones into a railway wagon. After a while, he became ill from hunger, and the words he said was that he was in the notion of dying. But he said he had a friend who his best friend, who was a Roman Catholic, and he said he scavenged, and he said he searched the bins. He said if he could catch a rat or a dog or a cat or anything that he could make edible, he cooked it up and he fed him. And he kept him going till one day they were in the hut, and this prisoner come in and he says, "I can hear a noise." And they said, "Well, what do you mean you can hear a noise?" He says, "I can hear a noise out there that I never heard before." So they went out and they listened, and some people thought they could hear a noise and some people could hear nothing. But they went out the next day and the same thing again. But then he said they could hear a noise. He said it was just a wee whisper. They didn't know who was winning the war. The Germans had told them that the Germans were winning the war and yous are not getting out of here alive, yous are going to be shot. So they had planned a mass suicide march over the rock face whenever they were certain that the Germans had won. But anyway, they heard this whisper. And he said each day the whisper got a little louder. He said they knew who was winning the war. And the whisper got louder each day, and eventually the whisper became a roar. It was the Allied guns coming south. So the war was very loud getting, the bombs and stuff, and one day the Americans come down the road and they opened the gate, and he just told them, "Yous are free men." The lock of the gate, he brought it home, it's at our house. I asked him, did he not get the key, but he said he didn't get it. So the lock's at our house, so there were free men. There was a guard, a German guard, he was a civilian who looked after them. He had a farm, he had hens. They were all very hungry, so they went down to the farm and asked the guard for some eggs. And the guard wouldn't give them any eggs, so they said, well, that was okay. So they went down to the hen house and they just took the hens. And the guard, he had nothing to say any longer, so they took the hens back up and they cooked the hens and they had a feed. And the words he said was, "They died round me like flies." He says, men that had spent 4 years and maybe more in the camp, he says they weren't fit to eat. He says, I watched them die. He didn't die. I think he wasn't fit to eat. I think maybe his friend was feeding him. Anyway, he was released. He came home and he was put in hospital in England. He was flew home in bombers. The RAF come in with bombers with seats in them, and they put them in there and flew them back to England. He was some time in hospital in England, then he was brought home. He came home to Ireland. He spent a while in St. Luke's, not because he was mad, but because it was been used as a military hospital at that time. And then eventually he got out. On his wedding photographs, he's like death warmed up, and that would have been maybe, well, I don't know, 4 or 5 years after the, maybe 6 years after the prison camp. He still was a skeleton. He come home, and anyway, he got a job working on the roads, and he was working with this wee fella, wee crabbed wee man called Archie Wilson, who was my grandfather. And he had a daughter called Annie Wilson, who was my mother. And anyway, he got to know Annie Wilson. But in the meantime, Annie Wilson had went to work for this man, John Anderson, who was a son of Emma Anderson, who had died whenever he was just a lad who had bid him farewell. She died about 1922-23, and each one, as I think I said, was taken into the room as she was dying, and she bid each one farewell, and she made each one promise that they would meet her in heaven. And I knew each one of those children when they were adults, and I watched them grow old and die, and I've no doubt that she has met each one of them in heaven. My mother went to work for him anyway, and there was a mission come to Liz Looney, and he invited her to the mission, so she went to the mission. She probably was in, I don't know, 15, 16. She heard things at the mission that day that she never heard before, things about being saved. She didn't know what the man was talking about. So eventually she did find out, and she got saved at the mission. She didn't, I don't think she had a Bible, she had a prayer book. She said she used to get up on the bed and say her prayers and read her prayer book, and she got saved at the mission. And then she met my father, and I've run out of time, but anyway, she met my father, and he was what you would call a broken man. He had been what you would call an atheist, but he said there was no atheists in a foxhole. He said whenever they got into a tight spot, he said they would all be praying, and they would make promises to God, but whenever the shooting stopped and the bombs quit falling, he said the promises was forgotten about. So he married mother anyway, and they set up home where I live today, and there we were born. We grew up there. It was their wish that each one of us would be saved, and each one of us did make a profession at that time, and most of us went on well with the Lord. I expect to meet the other seven in heaven. My mother's still living. She's 95 now, and she can still boil the kettle. My father, he died at 56, probably from ailments that he got during the war, because of the feeding he got and the treatment he got. Whenever they got married, his mother told my mother to think well of him, because he'll not be with you too long. So they went to the doctor and asked the doctor what this was about. And the doctor got out his records and he read off a spiel of diseases that I never heard before. My mother still can rhyme them off. And whenever he was finished, he says, well, we don't know. But he lived to 1976. Whenever he died, he developed heart problems, probably because of his injuries. He had lost a lung during the war, or after the war, or because of the war, whatever, and he passed away with renal failure, which kidney failure, in 1976. And my mother still lives. I got married, and I have to stop because Michelle Wunsch is in bed for 8 o'clock. But I got married and sat up home where I am now. Our house had been vacant, partly because of the troubles. We had to leave home, and we were living in Killalea, and I got married and sat up home. There was 4 girls born, each one of them. I've made professions, each one of them are saved and going on well. One sitting down there plays the organ. The other one is a school teacher, plays the organ in Dungannon and sings a bit too. And the other one, she's married to a minister in Ballyclare. And each one were born again, and none of them caused us any problems. I haven't time to talk of the day the doctors told me in the Royal, the Sunday afternoon, the doctors told me in the Royal that my wife might die. I was 27, she was 25. I'll let you tell her that. I'll let her tell you that someday, if she wants. And the carry on that went through there, and things that happened later on in life. One thing I will say, I usually attended the prayer meeting. I always thought it was my duty to attend the prayer meeting, because my mother was a great woman for praying. Whenever we were looking for mother when we were small, and you run around the house and run around the yard and you couldn't find her, well then you went into the sitting room. Very often you would find her there praying. Later on in life, we were very wild on motorbikes and cars, and I had a motorbike, and the only way a motorbike would go was as fast as you could get around the corners. But there became a great fear on me that something would happen. A dog would run out, tire would blow off, she would seize up, I would fall off and be killed, and I started to ride very slow. I was talking to one of the neighbours one day not so long ago about it. We were talking about motorbikes and stuff, and I was telling him this, and he says, why did you become afraid? I says, well, I don't know, but mother was praying, maybe that's something to do with it. So my mother prayed for me, and I always tried to attend the prayer meeting because I thought I owed that to my children as well. Thank you.